Sai Ram, dear listeners, this is Radio Sai Answering Booth, a show where you can send in your questions as on practical spirituality, and I will present answers based on Swami's message. I will only present the answers, for the answers are purely His. By the way, I'm Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I welcome you to this week's show. The other day, someone very casually asked me a question. This person asked me, what would be your answer if someone asks, I am leading a normal, happy life, why do I need spirituality? I thought about that question for a while. You know, it's like a student studying in, say, 5th standard asking, why should I go to the 6th standard? I'm perfectly happy here. I'm happy to spend all my life in this standard. Well, if you are happy to stay there, you're welcome to. But at some point in time, from within, not from out, a restlessness will begin. Maybe a feeling of boredom. Maybe you won't find the same happiness in the things you found plenty before. Maybe what meant the world a while ago begins appearing like trinkets. When that happens, you will on your own desire to move to the next level, isn't it? Same is the case even with a comfortable, happy and successful worldly life too. At some time, there will be that yearning from within to ask deeper questions. That inner push to seek solutions even for worldly problems in spiritual wisdom. This is but a natural progression of human life. But when we sense that spark of true seeking, it is up to us to protect it, foster it, and make it grow. That's what a spiritual life is all about. Otherwise, just like we are happy to spend more time in the 5th standard, we will only graduate to the 6th standard and start feeling, oh, I'm so happy here. I can spend my whole life in the 6th standard. Right then, time to dive right into the program. And as always, before we listen to the question for this week, permit me, dear listeners, to share with all of you a quote that I found inspiring and profound. The quote I'm going to read is from Martin Luther King Jr. These words are very, very true in many levels. It applies to social problems, domestic issues, and even individual crisis. And here it comes. I quote, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." End of quote. Well, there's really nothing much to explain in that quote. I think it's so very self-explanatory. But come to think of it, it does appear so logical, isn't it? How can we counter darkness with darkness if we wish to remove it? But still, we counter anger with anger, argument with argument, abuse with abuse, and sadness with more sadness. Where does our logic go when we do this? But we all do it. Where there is anger, it has to be dealt with calmness and patience. Where in a relationship there is hatred, it can only be solved with more love, not by reacting and responding with more hatred, isn't it? I know this is far easier said than done, and I say it with much humility, for I am completely conscious of the fact that I am as far away from these virtues and ideals as any of you are. And in fact, there must be some among you who are much more qualified to talk about patience and love than me. But this is not my advice. These are Swami's teachings, right? No matter from where it comes, when applied in everyday life, benefit is sure to be found. So next time when you face a problem, an angry colleague, hatred from someone, or even trolling on social media, try to counter it with just the opposite, rather than reacting and responding with the same emotion. So before going ahead to the question of the day, permit me, dear listeners, to read once again that beautiful quote by Martin Luther King Jr. I quote, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." The question for today is from a sister who has sent us her question from the United States. Though she wishes to be anonymous, she has been very kind to send the question in her own voice. So let's listen to the question. I am sure this question is something which probably a lot of us can relate to. So let's listen to the question in the listener's own voice.
Sai Ram brother, on many occasions, I force myself to do several actions because I feel it is my duty. But I feel miserable while doing the act. on self-analysis, I feel this is because of several fears that I have due to past experience, due to which I want to avoid the person or the situation. Another important reason for this is I do not like the person and wish to avoid the company. At the same time, if I do not do the action, I feel guilty. I find my mind constantly thinking about the person and incidents related to the person most of the time. How do I stop my mind from chattering? How do I go beyond likes and dislikes, attachment and hatred? How do I subjugate my ego?
Thank you, sister, for that question. How to go beyond likes and dislikes, attachment and hatred, and how to subjugate the ego? Well, I think the answer to that is what all spirituality is about, isn't it? Be it any spiritual path, at the end of it, we must have transcended the duality of like and dislike, and we must have overcome our ego completely. And when we talk about growing to dislike a person because of past experience, what is needed is the quality of forgiveness. And as I had mentioned in an earlier answer, the ability to forgive is actually a perfect indicator of our spiritual progress. As we grow in understanding, our ability to forgive those who have given us some unpleasantness in the past gradually increases. If this is not happening, then there is something wrong in the way we are going about in our spiritual path. So one thing is, all that you have asked will happen gradually with spiritual progress, but there are ways in which we should be able to bring that experience and wisdom to our present situation to handle the issues we are facing now too. And that is the idea of practical spirituality. When Arjuna said, I don't wish to participate in the war, I want to give up social life, go and sit in a forest, Lord Krishna tells him, you're not the body, you're eternal, and teaches him the secrets of creation, reveals his own divinity through the Vishwarupa. And at the end of all of that, Arjuna picks up his bow and goes for the fight, right? In other words, after being informed about the ultimate wisdom, he uses that wisdom, which he has not yet achieved, as a tool to perform the task at hand. In the same way, though as we grow in spirituality, we will develop these qualities, it is also worthwhile to look at methods which can enable us to perform our duties right now, using that wisdom, which we will eventually achieve and make our own, right? And the sign that we are progressing will be that, with time, what we do as conscious effort or practice will become natural or spontaneous. In the first mail that you sent to me, sister, you made a reference to one of Swami's quotes, duty without love is deplorable. I thought that was a very relevant reference that you made. Just in case some listeners may not know the whole quote, though I think that's quite improbable, the quote that Swami would many times say in his discourses, duty with love is desirable, duty without love is deplorable, and love without duty is divine. But for now, we will focus just on the first two parts of the quote, because the question pertains to that to start with, right? The idea is, as much as possible, we must perform our duties with love. Swami would especially make a reference to this idea when he's talking to, say, Sevadal, or especially people working in the ashram, like yours humbly. Many people come and settle in the ashram and take up some form of seva as part of their sadhana, right? They will be very diligent in their duty. They will be the first to come for work, last to leave work. They will be embodiments of sincerity when it comes to their work. But unfortunately, some of them are so unpleasant in their disposition that they end up spoiling the mood of everyone who happened to interact with them during the day. Of course, such people are very much part of the process that Swami wanted all devotees to undergo and go through. But they as individuals also had to work on their attitude. And that is why Swami has made reference to such behavior with much displeasure. And Swami would say, you know, you are doing your duty sincerely, doing it with the idea that you're doing it for Swami. But if there is no love, what is the whole use? What is the purpose? My devotees are shouted at so much by you people that you all appear like Alsatians and bulldogs to them. You know, this is what Swami would say on multiple occasions in discourses. In fact, in the discourse, Swami said, I keep calling you all Prema Swarupa, but you earn titles of Alsatians and bulldogs for my devotees. So the point is, yes, the first step is that we must do our duty sincerely. And the second is, do it with love. I know, sister, you are asking in reference to situations in the family, but I wanted to contrast this with how it happens in a family and how the approach has to be a little different and also a little similar. We see this in most government offices, especially in India, right? You would have a grumpy person sitting behind the counter. You ask anything more, ask any clarification, that person will yell at you. Or sometimes there will be a person who is probably by nature pleasant. So if you are pleasant to him or her, they will behave kindly. But if the customer is rude or happens to irritate them, then the person just loses patience and the unpleasant mood spills over probably to the others in the line too. In a general scenario in a workplace, there is no love as such, if you ask me. The person could be by nature pleasant or unpleasant. And also depending on whom they are interacting with, they may lose their patience sooner or later. Let us contrast this with what happens at home. At home, within the family, there is already a base of love. As I mentioned in an answer earlier, Swami explained this to a student. He said, your father loves you because he feels that you belong to him. So that sense of belonging creates a base of love, which is actually absent in a workplace or when we interact in the society at large. A mother does her duties because she loves her family, and she loves her family because it is her family, right? So in a family, first love, and on that is based duty. But in work and in the society, it is purely duty based on probably righteousness, right? But because there is a love present as the basis when it comes to the family, it is a case of feeling hurt when someone says or does something unpleasant. The question is, how to protect or rekindle that love? In a workplace, we need to work hard to first create that base of love in the first place, right? Well, honestly, there is no new technique or remedy I'm going to tell here. For both cases, what helps is the solution that Swami always gives. Learning and practicing to see Swami in every person. Every person that we interact with at home or office or elsewhere, right? Especially for those like us who have chosen the path of devotion, this is a very, very valid tool and the goal as well. When I began, I said in the spiritual path, we use the qualities and of the ultimate stage as a tool in the present, right? A devotee ultimately sees Swami within and in every person that comes into their life. So if that is the ultimate quality, even for our path, even to benefit in our life right now, we can bring that quality and try and make it a practice. And eventually, this practice along with the other spiritual exercises we do will make this ability to see Swami in all spontaneous. But we will leave the ultimate state for now. But this practice is a very helpful tool in many ways. I'll try and explain how it works in these two different scenarios. One at home where there is already some love, and out in the society where, as such, there is no love to start with, but we wish to bring in some. And what should we really be conscious of, and what it means when we say we must try and see Swami in others. Let us first talk about the case in work, or in the society in general. One thing that Swami says is that we must do all work as God's work, right? But I feel even this is sometimes not enough. This will bring in sincerity for sure. Like in the case of those staff in the ashram I spoke about, they don't have to imagine they're working for God because they were actually working for God. They were working for Swami. And that feeling was quite natural. But even that did not bring in that love in all cases. Of course, most people will do it with love because they know that that is how Swami wants them to work in the ashram. But in general, just the thought that we are working for Swami in most cases guarantees sincerity in duty, but not necessarily love in duty. When we bring in this practice of trying to see Swami in others, we create that base of love. Since there is no sense of belonging when it comes to strangers or sometimes even our own colleagues, when we try and see Swami in them, we are actually creating a base for love. We are creating that sense of belonging. So whoever that person is, I am interacting with the Swami within that person, and that Swami I have a lot of love for. So you see, you bring in love where it was not there before. In fact, to learn to do this is one of the reasons Swami would ask us to go and do seva. When we do service, clearly we are trying to see Swami in the person we are serving, right? We sometimes don't realize it, but it is easiest to see Swami in the person we are going out to serve. Because we are already showing love in the form of service, and we have to only visualize Swami in that person, see Swami's smile in that person's smile. And there are innumerable instances where Swami would show to people that it was He who was receiving through that person, isn't it? Both to remind devotees when they were not doing seva with the right attitude, and also to reward devotees who were doing it correctly. But a mistake that most of us do is, we leave what we learn through service there in the field of service. The whole idea is to bring that experience or the practice of seeing Swami in the person we serve to everyday activity as well. So when we bring it to our workplace and in society in general, the reverse happens. There we do it with love, so it is easier to see Swami in that person. Here, since we are trying to see Swami in others, love starts featuring in our interactions. Sometime back, I happened to participate in a study circle where one of the participants, also a Swami student, shared this beautiful analogy. We were discussing about Vandanam, you know, one of the aspects of Navaveda Bhakti, where this concept of how to see Swami in all and what will be the consequences if we are able to do that. It seems once Swami had given this analogy, say you're walking past the house of a person whom you're not very fond of. You don't even want to look at that person's face. By chance, you happen to glance at the house and you see a large picture of Swami inside. Though you don't like the person, you will still have reverence for that Swami's picture you see, isn't it? And as we do in the Indian tradition, you may even offer a small pranam right there. Swami said, similarly, keep reminding yourself that Swami is there in each person you come across. You may or may not like that person, but the Swami within is always worthy of our reverence and love. Let me give you another analogy before we move to the issue of that you raised in the family. Let's say you're walking along the road and by the side there is some slush. And there you find something glittering and one look and you know it's a diamond or something precious like that. Will the fact that the diamond is in slush reduce its value or inhibit your attraction to it or even stop you from trying to pick it up? The value of that diamond appeals to you much, much more than the repulsion you feel to the filthiness of the slush around, right? Okay, if you say I'm not a person who will pick up random things from the road, imagine that you've lost your wedding ring and you find it in the slush. The idea I'm trying to establish is, the more valuable the object is, the lesser the filthiness of the surrounding matters to you. In the same manner, if this act of seeing Swami in others has to benefit us, our love for Swami should be so strong that He is so valuable that the person who happens to be in front of us and his or her nature pales in significance. There may be filthy slush around, but I can see only the precious diamond in there. So the point is, trying to see Swami in others in work, during a commute, in public, will bring in a certain amount of love into all that we do. And this will be enhanced the more and more we love and value Swami. It does not mean we will start falling at the feet of each person we see, but a sense of belonging which will lead to love. And this will reflect in how we do our work. You know, one of our doctors at the Bangalore Super Speciality Hospital has this practice. He refers to every patient as Swami. He actually tells the patient, please come Swami, please sit down Swami. How are you feeling today Swami? And if it's a lady, he'll tell me, Amma, what is your problem? Amma, lift your hand. And he says, it's not uncommon to refer to people as Swami and Amma in India, but in his mind, he's always telling that I'm treating Swami, I'm listening to Swami. And he says that just that thought brings in so much more patience and kindness. It is not necessary we go around calling each other Swami, but try and practice it as much as you can. But finally, let me come to the problem in the family. As I said, when it comes to the family, this solution of seeing Swami in that person does help, but as the problem is quite different, the way it works is also quite different. When we already love a person and we have been kind to them, cared for them, if they don't respond with that same love, or if something happens and they've been unpleasant to us, we feel very hurt, right? And the next time we try to avoid that person, or as sister you mentioned, we sometimes even avoid our duty towards them because we don't feel that same love anymore. So since Swami says duty without love is deplorable, is it better to avoid the duty itself because we are no more able to do it with love? Well, certainly not. Swami was clearly giving the comparison between doing one's duty with love and without love, which means he kept the basis as duty must be done. There is no debate on that. But doing it with love is always desirable. Though I don't think you are asking with that idea, I would like to say this in general. The stance that now there is no more love in this relationship, so what is the point in holding on to the duty, is not the right approach. In that sense, I feel your approach is good because you are asking how to give up like and dislike, how to subjugate the ego, because that I feel shows that you know the duties have to be done, but you only wish to know how to bring love into it. Well, having made that remark, let me come back to seeing Swami in others. When it comes to general people, the problem was we had no basis for love. But when it comes to being hurt in a family, it becomes an issue of attachment. Well, you might say, where is the question of attachment when it comes to a person you are not fond of? You know, you can be attached to parents or your children. Certainly, there is no question of being attached to that person in the family you are not able to put up with, isn't it? Well, there's another definition for attachment, and that is love with expectations. Love becomes absolutely pure when there are no expectations. But the fact is, all our love has some form of expectation or the other, especially when we speak of the scenario in a family. The reason why we feel hurt when someone misbehaves or says something unpleasant is that it was not expected of them. We expected that they will be kind, understanding, straightforward, and will return our love. So two things. People can be sometimes pleasant and sometimes unpleasant. And the second is, people don't always respond to our love the way we expect. This is true in general too, but we tend to face this problem more within our close circles. When it is just a random person or an acquaintance, we can avoid that person, right? But it becomes very difficult if it is a person to whom we are bound by duty, say our in-laws, an uncle or an aunt, siblings, or maybe even a colleague whom we are supposed to work with. So how does seeing Swami in these people help us address these two issues? There's one common experience that most of us who've had the fortune to be around Swami physically have experienced. Swami too would express different moods and emotions. Swami always did everything out of love, there's no doubt about that. But the Swami we see will have all emotions. One day Swami will speak very lovingly. All of a sudden Swami would stop talking. For long Swami will be patient with your errors. One fine day suddenly Swami will be so wild that you won't know where to hide. One day when you do a good act, Swami will come and appreciate you in front of all people and encourage you. Sometimes for years Swami will not acknowledge that you have done something right or good. And to an extent, people like us who speak about Swami are to be blamed for that. Because we share mostly only that aspect of Swami which in a worldly sense is loving and kind, right? But the fact is, though Swami was loving all the time, externally, Swami would show all these different attributes too. And that is why when we were students, you know, we would say, forget seeing Swami in others. First, we must learn to see Swami in Swami, you know. Which means, first, we must learn to see that loving Swami behind his anger, smile, partiality, coldness and everything. And this was the training Swami gave us. Now we know that Swami's love can come in so many ways, right? Because of that training. Similarly, keep this in mind when interacting with people and when you're trying to see Swami in them. If you remember that even Swami could sometimes appear very irrational to our perspective, and we have to look beyond that and love Swami, we will be able to do that when it comes to the people around us as well, isn't it? Now coming to the expectation part, as I said, when we love someone or have been kind to someone and they do not reciprocate that, we tend to feel very, very hurt. That's quite natural. But the moment we start seeing Swami in that person, we actually have little to do with that particular person. Our love, care, duty is all directed only towards the Swami within. Gradually, our expectation from that individual reduces. Also, when we do receive love from a person, even then we will see it as coming from Swami, but only through a particular individual. In other words, you love Swami in all, and any love that comes to you also comes only from Swami. So we no more will say, for example, you know, my mother-in-law did not respond to my kindness, I was kind to my brother and he was rude to me. We will think instead in this way: I showed love to Swami in my mother-in-law, but probably Swami responded through, say, my father-in-law or sister-in-law. I was kind and loving to my brother, but Swami reciprocated that love through a friend. That way, you neither will get attached to one person nor feel repulsed from another person. We all will still have our preferences, there's no doubt about that. But when we learn to see Swami in all, it will enable us to bring so much more balance in our own approach to life. Once one of our teachers was telling us, you know, that initially he would find it very difficult to accept this. Many times Swami would, you know, shout at him for no apparent reason, or when clearly it was not his mistake at all. He said, then he would think, so many times Swami comes and praises me when I have not done anything apparently great. Swami showers so much love, and I know I have not done anything to deserve it. Well, in those times, I accept that very happily. Why then should I be hesitant to accept Swami's anger when there is no apparent reason? It is not necessary that Swami should reward us just today for what we did today, or reprimand us today itself for the mistake we did today. When we love Him, we accept His timing and His ways too. Similarly, when we go about our duty as being done only to the Swami in the various people we come across, Swami may choose to respond through that very person, that very day, or maybe through a completely random person on a completely random day, isn't it? When we go about this way, it is just a matter of time before being loving to everyone becomes our very nature. And what is our nature will no more depend or change with the person who is before us. Just like the classic Chinnakatha that Swami says of the sage who is trying to save the scorpion that was drowning in the water, and every time he picked it up, it started stinging him. When asked, the sage replies, look, my nature is to try to save one in pain. The scorpion's nature is to sting. So I am only sticking to my nature. In that way, the ability to be loving will slowly become independent of who is receiving that love from us. Love will become our very nature. Well, I better stop here. I've said a lot. Let me try and summarize what I've tried to convey. The best way to bring love into our duty is to try and practice seeing Swami in all. This is one of the reasons we do seva. When we serve, we are supposed to see Swami in that person. This experience has to be replicated in everyday life. It is easy to see Swami in a stranger whom we know nothing about, or even a person we serve. It is more difficult seeing Swami in our friends and colleagues, and it is most difficult to see Swami in those whom we know too well about, especially if we know all their flaws. But that is the increasing level of implementation of this technique. In our workplace, or when we interact with strangers, when we see Swami in them, we create a sense of belonging which becomes the base for love. Whereas within the family, that belonging is already there. But in a family, since love is already there, the problem is when our sentiments or feelings are hurt, or when people don't respond the way we expect. When we practice seeing Swami in all, we direct all our love to Swami and will not be particular that that person has to respond. Every person who showers love on us will only be seen as a conduit for Swami's love. So the attitude becomes, I showed love to Swami in this individual, I received love from Swami from another individual. There will be no attachment to this one or that one. And Swami would say, no appointments, no disappointments. Well, none of this will happen over days or will be easy. But when we know this is the change that is meant to happen in us, we can consciously strive for that. I did not go much into the quality of forgiveness, for I had spoken in detail about that as a reply to a similar query. But one final thought. You know what differentiates man from animals? Animals have to accept what is in front of them as it is. But man leaped ahead of the animal kingdom when he began mastering the art of extracting what he wanted from what was in front of him. He learned to take iron ore out of the earth. He learned to take iron out of the iron ore. He could take paddy, remove the seeds from there, remove the grains from the husk and eat just what he wanted. This ability to focus on what is of value and discard or ignore the rest differentiated man from animals. If we have to move from the stage of man to God, we have to do the very same process. We have to develop this ability to see the divinity in the person before us, ignoring or overlooking the animality and the human frailties. The day we are able to do that 100% of the time, we would have stepped ahead of the human nature and stepped into the divine nature. So thank you, sister, for your question. This practicing of seeing Swami in others is a technique which is sure to work. You know, just like all other suggestions, we cannot wake up one day and effortlessly see Swami in everyone. It needs practice. And our sincerity also will be tested in the process. But even as we start practicing it, we will see that we are able to feel so much more lighter and peaceful. If you have anything more to ask, of course, feel free to write to me. That, dear listeners, was the question for today. So what are we going to do for the rest of the time? Well, I'm going to share with you a story which is definitely not new to anybody, but I think it's a story which is worth repeating as many times and any number of times. You know, when we look at Swami's life, there are innumerable number of incidences, experiences, Swami curing people of incurable diseases, Swami transforming people, and, you know, some people whose life itself is a long marathon of miracles. That's how an avatar's life actually is. But when we look at the other avatar, let's say you take the life of Lord Krishna or the life of Lord Rama, we have the Ramayana, we have the Bhagavatam, we have the Mahabharata. In comparison to Swami's life, sometimes, I don't know, I feel it sometimes, that we know far lesser anecdotes and stories of devotees compared to we know of Swami's life, right? Even as we are living through, there's so many people, and you could just walk into Kulwant Hall and everybody there will have an experience. And for that matter, every one of you who is listening to the show might be able to share something, not just with the universal Swami, but even the physical Swami, the physical interaction part. But I sometimes wonder, why is it that only a very few stories get passed on through the epics like Ramayana or Mahabharata? I feel there could be three reasons for that. You know, one could be that maybe that was part of the blessing that that devotee received. For instance, you know, whenever I listen to the story of Gajendra Moksham, I wonder what's so special about that story. It was, after all, an elephant who was probably caught by a crocodile, and it cried out to Lord Vishnu, and Lord Vishnu come and saved it. I mean, we've heard plenty such stories in Swami's life. What is great about that incident that it had to be chronicled in the Bhagavatam and had to be passed on for generations? So maybe, probably that was part of the blessing. For instance, the life of Dhruva. You know, Dhruva was told that you will become the pole star, and which means that you will be known for generations to come. Maybe it was part of that blessing. The second reason could be that, you know, the story of the devotee is part of the story of the Lord. For instance, you can't have the Mahabharata without talking about the relationship between Krishna and Arjuna. You can't speak about the Ramayana without talking about Hanuman, or without mentioning Angada, or even without mentioning that the character of Guha, probably, right? But there is a third reason, and I think that reason is why we go back to these epics, we go back to these stories which the epics give us. And that reason is, many stories which are passed on to us are stories which are valuable even today whose lessons are meant for today more than the time when it happened. I feel many times sages like Vyasa or Valmiki have picked out episodes which are relevant even to the ages which will come. And that is why some stories get highlighted, and even when Swami would have a drama presented in front of him, or when he was writing something, the emphasis that he would give on certain characters would be more, because those were the lessons which are meant for this day and age. And I feel one such devotee and one such episode in the Ramayana is the story of Mother Shabari, and which is not new to any of us. I'm sure all of us would have heard it. But I just want to recollect that story today and mention a few things which appeal to me, and just want to share my feelings and thoughts with all of you. The story goes that Mother Shabari, as a pretty young lady, she comes to the ashram of Rishi Matanga. And in those days, there was a lot of strictness about women being a part of an ashram. So she comes there, and there is this sage with all his disciples. So she feels that she is not going to get the opportunity to be a disciple in the ashram to sage Matanga. So what she does is, she hides behind bushes and trees and serves these sages even without their knowledge. What she would do is, she would walk along the path where these people would walk for their bath every morning, and she would clear the path of thorns and small stones, and as the story goes, that sometimes she had to clear a long path and there was a lot to cover, and as she was getting old, what she would do is she would roll on the path so that the thorns and the stones would get cleared. This was her form of offering worship to this sage Matanga, whom she had accepted as her guru. Or she would cut firewood and place it in front of the ashram. And for a long time, none of them noticed that. None of them could make out who was doing all this. But they just knew that some soul was hidingly doing all this. Finally, sage Matanga sees this lady. By then, Shabari is an old lady who's doing this. So Matanga very lovingly calls her and says, "Mother, why do you trouble yourself like this? Please come and stay in the ashram. You know, you can still serve us if that's what gives you happiness. But you stay in the ashram and be with all of us." So that's how she becomes an inmate of the ashram of Rishi Matanga. And then she continues with her service to the Rishi and his disciples. One fine day, Rishi Matanga calls Mother Shabari and he tells her that, "You know, my time has come. I need to move on now. But I wish that you stay back here in the ashram." And Mother Shabari, of course, starts revolting. She's so much in devotion with this sage. She says, "You know, why are you leaving me behind? If you're going, then you should take me along. And please don't do this to me. I've served you all my life. You know, please take me along with you." But sage Matanga has a completely different idea. He says, "You know, the Lord has come down in the human form. He's come as Lord Rama. And he's living in Ayodhya. And there's going to be a day when he will come by this way. And I wish that Lord Rama should step into this ashram and sanctify it. And more than the fact that I want him to sanctify the ashram, I want you to have this chance of being a host to Lord Rama, of having this opportunity of seeing and speaking to him. And that is why I insist that you should not leave your body. You should stay here and wait for Rama to come." Right? So Shabari is, of course, bound by her obedience to her master, and also this is a boon which is coming her way unasked. So she accepts it, and from that day on, she prepares and waits for the Lord to come. But just to give you a perspective, Rama is born in Ayodhya, which probably in the present day it's in Uttar Pradesh, and the Matanga Muni's ashram is in Rishyamukha Parvat, which is probably somewhere near Karnataka, where Hampi or somewhere, that's where the kingdom of Kishkinta and all of these places are. And Rama is there in Ayodhya. Where was he going to come to this forest where this lady was waiting? But Matanga gives her the whole story of Ramayana. Matanga tells her that, you know, Rama is the Lord. He will prevail upon Kaikeyi and Mantara to conspire to send him to the forest on exile. And he will come here, and the fake Sita will be taken away by Ravana, and Rama will pretend as though he is very despondent, and he will come in search of her, and when he comes down south, that's when he'll come here and he will come and meet you. So Mother Shabari is waiting for Rama, and for years and years and years, she wakes up every day thinking that that would be the day she would meet Rama. And what does she do? She clears the path leading to the ashram, picks every thorn, picks every stone, and then she goes and plucks berries, and she chooses among those berries what is the best, the most sweetest ones. Then she keeps it aside for Rama, and she waits the whole day, hoping that on that day Rama would come. And at the end of the day, she eats the berries as her prasadam, and that's all she eats. And she waits for the next day, and she starts this whole ritual again. And she does this for years and years and decades and decades. And finally, one day when she is clearing the path, she finds two people walking towards her. And, you know, many authors put it in different ways. Some say that she did not recognize Rama, and she, she starts shouting at the brothers for walking on the path she was clearing and all of that. But the way Swami writes it is very, very beautiful, because Swami says the moment Shabari sees Rama and Lakshmana, the introductions have not happened, but there is something in her heart which is, you know, which is racing. Her heart starts racing, her heart is beginning to overflow with joy, and she realizes that probably these two are the ones she's been waiting for so many decades. So she goes to them, and she is not able to take her eyes off Lord Rama, and she's actually doing Namasmarana. She's saying Rama, Rama, Rama. And Lakshmana, who sees this, thinks that probably this is another Rakshasa who's come in this form to trick them. But, you know, Rama is transfixed on her, and she is transfixed on Rama's face. So Rama holds her by hand and brings her to a tree, and they sit under it. And then Mother Shabari asks these two men, "Who are you?" And that's when Rama actually introduces himself, and he says, "Mother, I am the Prince of Ayodhya. My name is Ram, and this is my brother Lakshman." And, you know, the heart already knew. It was the reasoning mind which needed the introduction. And the moment that introduction came, you know, there was nothing that could stop the floodgates. Now, Shabari starts crying, and she says, "You know, Master Lord, you realize that I've been waiting for you for all these years." And she narrates the whole story of how Matangamuni asked her to wait. And she said, "My guru wanted that you should sanctify the ashram by your foot. I mean, by your, stepping into the ashram." And she says, "The ashram is just a few feet away. Would you kindly grace it?" So Rama is more than happy. He says, "Mother, anything that you ask, I am here for that." And then this lady who was, who was bent by age, she could hardly walk. When Rama and Lakshmana see her, she was literally dragging her body, and she was groaning with pain even as she was doing her work. When she enters the ashram with Rama and Lakshmana, she's suddenly filled with energy. She's running all around the place, and she runs to the river. She brings water. She gives it to Rama, and Rama and Lakshmana are looking at each other, and they're surprised, and they're saying that, you know, this is the same old person who was struggling to walk, and now see how she's jumping about like a deer. And Shabari is not having words to express what is going on in her mind, and, you know, she makes them sit, and then she brings the berries which she, for every day, for years and years, she would do this, and finally the day had come when the berries that she had collected could be offered to Rama, and she gives it to Rama. And she had this practice which she would do, you know, she would collect these berries, and most of the time the berries would not be plucked from the branches or trees. They had to be picked up from the floor, because those were the ones which were really ripe. So from the ones she picks up from the floor, she would dust them. And from the ones that she has dusted and cleaned, she would eat. And those which were sweet, those which were the most nectarous among the berries that she had plucked, she would keep it aside for Rama. So that day when Rama is sitting there, you know, she does this whole thing. She picks up a berry, she wipes it, then she takes a small bite, and she discards a few, thinking that it's not sweet enough. And the sweet one she gives to Rama. And here is Rama, who is like, probably that's the grandest of feast he's ever had. And he's eating so very happily, and Lakshmana is so surprised to see this. Because one thing is, this lady was offering something to the Lord, which she was biting and giving. But the other thing was, for many, many weeks and months, when Rama and Lakshmana were roaming the forest searching for Sita, Rama had not eaten properly for many, many days. And Lakshmana literally had to force Rama to eat. And that was one of the reasons Swami says that Lakshmana stayed alive because otherwise he was so very upset with himself for leaving Sita alone that he would have killed himself for that mistake of his. But he says that if I kill myself, who will take care of Rama? And now Rama needs somebody to ensure that he eats and sleeps more than any other time. So that's how Lakshmana in fact keeps himself alive, and that's Lakshmana's devotion. That's a different story by itself. But Lakshmana is so surprised that all these days I had to force him to eat, I had to force him to sleep, and with much difficulty he would eat a quarter fruit, a fruit, a half a fruit. But here is he, I mean, relishing this food like anything else. And Mother Shabari is having no words, and she's saying, Rama, this is all I have to offer. You know, in this forest you don't get anything else. And in response to that, Rama explains why those fruits were so sweet. And I think I just want to read those lines from Swami's own words, what Rama says in reply when Shabari says that I don't have anything else to offer other than these berries. And Rama says, Mother, these fruits are as sweet as your own heart. Really, these are not fruits that grow on trees. Why? The wild fruits that grow in jungles are not so sweet at all. They can never be. These are fruits that have grown on the holy tree of life, on the branches of pure mind, in the sunshine of love. What beautiful words, is it? I just repeat that last sentence again. These are fruits that have grown on the holy tree of life, on the branches of the pure mind, in the sunshine of love. It was not that act of Shabari picking up the berries that day and, you know, tasting the berries and offering. It was not that which made the berries sweet. Every one of those days which he waited for Rama, which he pined for him and kept chanting his name, I think each one of those days were responsible for making that berry sweet that day. And that's what Rama was saying, that these are not mere fruits, these are fruits from the tree of life. And these have literally grown on a pure mind under the sunshine of love. And, you know, what can you tell about Shabari? She's actually, the story goes that she's from a very low caste, she's not educated, she runs away from her family. And, I mean, even in the ashram, she does not really get educated as such. She just participates in all the satsangs with the guru, but she never learns. She's still an unlettered person. And, you know, Mother Shabari says, Lord, you look so very radiant, you look so very beautiful. I don't even have the scholarship to, you know, describe you. And, I mean, even the best of poets become mute when they want to praise you. And here I am, I'm an illiterate, I don't have any scholarship, and I'm a lowborn, but you are gracing me with this opportunity. And again, you know, what Swami says in reply to that is so very beautiful. Swami writes this as Rama's reply to Shabari when she says that I'm a lowborn, I'm an illiterate, I have no scholarship. And Swami writes, Mother, devotion is the thing I need. The rest are subsidiary. Other things like scholarship, intelligence, status, social prestige, caste, I do not pay any attention to them. They are of no value in my eyes. More than all the powers gained by spiritual disciplines and austerities, I relish the sweetness of devotion saturated with love. I seek only that. A man who has no love in him is as barren as a cloud with no moisture, a tree without fruits, or a cow yielding no milk. He is ever far from God and can never earn grace. Shabari, of the 9 ways of evincing the and cultivating devotion, I only desire that any one be followed consistently by man. But I find you have followed to the very end all the 9 ways. So, I do not see anyone higher than you in spiritual attainment. I am indeed elated in all manners of ways, for you have offered me devotion from the heart, and surging from it in all directions and towards all directions and towards all beings. You have not cast aspersions on anyone, even while dreaming. That is what makes your mind so pure. Your mind does not blossom when good comes to you, nor does it wither when bad comes. You are blessed in all ways. What a beautiful passage, because in this Swami describes everything that matters to him. He says that, you know, social status and earning and all of this does not matter. I only want that you find any way of worshipping me and you stick to that. And of course he says that Mother Shabari, you are embodiment of all the nine paths. But then he says that, you know, what makes the mind pure? What makes the mind pure is when you don't hate anybody or want to harm or hurt anybody, even in your wildest of dreams. Swami says, Shabari, you've been like that, so that is why, you know, you are dearer to me than anybody else. And then finally he says that, you know, you are calm even when good happens to you, you are calm even when bad happens to you. And that is again a quality which I love. That's what Swami says through the words of Rama. And I think these are all messages for us. And that's why I said, these are stories which are relevant even today. And that is why, among the hundreds and thousands of devotees whose lives Rama would have touched, these few, maybe 10, 15 or even fewer than that, they have been passed on to us. And it is very, very important for us to relive and reread and rehear these stories again and again. And finally, continuing with the story after this interaction, Mother Shabari then goes on to tell all those things which Sage Matanga has told her about her Rama's journey. And Rama, like a normal individual, he asks, do you know where Mother Sita has gone? And she tells the whole story, and Ravana has taken her to Lanka, and my sage has told me that you will come here in search of her, and you'll have to go to Rishimukha. There's Sugriva there. He will be the one who guides you and all of that. So all the while, you know, imagine this devotee. She knows that here is the Lord whom she has waited for all her life. And she knows that he is the perfect one. But he, like a normal human being, asks, where do I go? Whom should I meet? What should I do? And, you know, Shabari, with a smile on her face, she says, Lord, you know everything, but you want to play. So let me play along. And she tells the whole story. And, you know, then she says, Lord Rama, I have nothing to ask. I have nothing more to gain. It's over. I mean, whatever I had to ask has been granted to me unasked. And Swami writes that she creates a fire from out of a yogic power from within, and she ends her life right in front of Lord Rama. You know, many people ask, we've been worshipping Swami for so long, we've been loving Swami for so long, and you know, some of these people have this practice, which is a very, very good one, I'm not saying otherwise, of sitting in front of Swami's picture and talking to Swami, or people who will sit in the altar and tell about the whole, everything that's happened during the day. Many people have these habits, right? And some of them ask this question of, you know, I keep talking to Swami, but Swami never talks back. You know, I've been speaking to him, but he never speaks back. You know, it only reminds me of that beautiful bhajan in Hindi, which, of course, it's not sung in Mandir. It's a Hindi traditional bhajan where it goes, the lines are, Log kehte hain, Bhagwan khate nahi, tumne shabri ki tarah khilate, tum shabri ki tarah khilate nahi. That's what the bhajan goes up. I might have got the words a little wrong. But the thing is, people complain that God does not eat. Log kehte hain, Bhagwan khate nahi. People say that I keep food for Swami every day in the altar, I keep delicacies, I make this, I make that. But Swami never eats, right? And the bhajan goes that, have you fed him the way Mother Shabari fed him? Because it doesn't take one day to receive that blessing, you know. It is that years and years of patience, and during that patience, that focus, you know, that's what makes Mother Shabari stand out. She did not merely wait for the Lord. She did not say that, okay, sometime, you know, Rama will come. But that preparedness and that focus and that readiness to have the Lord every day. He could come today. He could come tomorrow. He could come any moment. That readiness, you know, it made her so pure that finally when that meeting did happen, there was nothing more. There was nothing more to achieve but just that moment of merging with the Lord. And I think that was a lesson that we need to take from the story. And every story of the Ramayana or Mahabharata which has been passed on to us, especially those stories which Swami would himself repeat, and I think we can take it for granted that each one of those stories are valuable lessons for our life. And if we can be focused enough to absorb them I'm sure every step that we take is one step closer to Swami. Well, that, dear listeners, it's a wrap for this week's Answering Booth. And if you have any questions, especially about practical spirituality, you can write in to me. You can send me a mail. My mail ID is prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. It would be wonderful if you can send me a question in your own voice, like the listener today. And that way I would be happy to have a different voice reading out the question on my show. If you wish that your name should not be revealed on the show, I think that can be handled, because this is my personal mail ID and nobody else reads these mails. So your confidentiality is guaranteed. You can tell me if you want to be anonymous and I won't mention your name. Thank you all for being with me. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. I'm going to leave you with a very, very, very beautiful song. On the other side of it, we'll continue with the programs, Brother Raghu's program on the Ashtotram. And after that, I'll be back with Arvind for the afternoon satsang for this week. But for the Radio Sai Answering Booth, you will have to wait one more week and join me next Thursday at 11 o'clock.
Yeah. devare ram.